Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movie.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is Birth of the Beatles, a bona fide Beatles biopic made in 1979. As the on-screen intro at the start of the film explains, the following is a dramatisation using actors of the early career of the Beatles. It is based on factual accounts including the recollections of former Beatle Pete Best, as well as other sources. The music sung during this period by the Beatles was recorded for this dramatisation by the group Rain. Now, just quickly on that. Bit weird that they mentioned the actual tribute band on the on-screen disclaimer at the start of the film. I guess, for clarification's sake, it's worth pointing out that despite this being the only Beatles biopic that was made when all four band members were alive, and that meant that all four were around to actually aggressively oppose the making of the film and its release, it did actually manage to secure rights to have actual Lennon and McCartney songs in the soundtrack. So I wonder if this mention of the tribute band Rain in the on-screen introduction is some kind of like legal disclaimer, sort of a weird sort of grey area place that the film sort of finds itself in.
Yeah, I wonder. It's an odd thing to start with. And it does, the word disclaimer is a good one. Like, it does feel like a disclaimer.
Yeah.
A very few, well, I mean, so films do start with a disclaimer sometimes, but you know, they tend to be for the avoidance of a criminal action of some kind, or you know,
it's not setting off on its right tone, is it?
Like, no, exactly. You know, you think, oh, this will be a laugh. Yeah. You know, this is all about my favorite band, and now it's, oh god. Well, is this okay? Is it legal for me to watch this?
Yeah, but also those disclaimers are always the versions depicted in this film are fictionalized.
Yes,
right. Whereas calling out, by the way, the versions of the Beatles songs you're hearing at the moment aren't the actual ones performed and released by the Beatles.
Yeah.
That feels weird to me. Like, you just, yeah, that, you know, that's what the credits are for.
Yes, yeah. And actually that feels like the kind of thing that they were, it feels like a stipulation put on them.
Yes, yeah, I wondered that as well, yeah.
I guess. So my understanding, now, I'm not a music publishing expert, as you know. there are other Beatles podcasts that you would be much better off listening to for the absolute chapter and verse on the history of Northern songs and how publishing rights work. But in 1979, Northern Songs was owned by ATV still. Lennon and McCartney did not have a controlling interest in it. My assumption, therefore, is that Lennon and McCartney, if they had wanted to block the use of Lennon and McCartney songs in this film, would have been unable to. But I don't know exactly how
they would have been able to block using their own recordings or their own performances of them, perhaps, and holding the songwriting copyright on them as opposed to the publishing copyright.
I'm not sure, to be honest.
But, I feel like it's split between the two. Like so ATV would have owned the publishing rights for the songs, which allows the another band or act or performer to actually perform those same songs.
Yeah.
Which is what we have here. And more or less, they're performed pretty much as close as possible to the original recordings, I feel like.
Yeah, I think so. They're performed very competently. And I think in terms of the singers impersonating the Beatles' voices are doing a pretty good job. But actually, one of the things about it is that it's covering, I think we'll talk about this in a bit more depth later, but it is covering very similar ground to Backbeat, which is a film we've already done an episode about. And so it's sort of interesting to compare the two. And one of the main ways in which they're very different is the use of the music or the performance of the music. Backbeat, because it's got those songs are sort of performed by artists with a sort of punk ethos, if you like, artists from the sort of the grunge era at the time. These are not. At all. These are very, very polite renderings of the sort of rock and roll songs the Beatles were playing at the time. And so there's a scene near the start where you're supposed to be shown, oh, wow, these guys are so much different to everything else around. So they go into, they're auditioning for something or other. Mm. And there's one of those Shadows type bands on before them and they're all doing dance steps.
Yeah.
And this is supposed to juxtapose them with the Beatles then coming on and sort of tearing the roof off it. And they play Dizzy Miss Lizzy, I think, and it's perfectly good, but there's no energy to it. There's no, all of its rough edges have been shaved off. And so you don't think to yourself, oh, this is, I can completely see why they sort of took Liverpool by storm and became such a big thing, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Because you don't get that sense at all.
No,
and so going back a bit, the film depicts the Beatles in their at the start of their career. So from the time which they get the gig to go to Hamburg, their time spent there, which is obviously where it sort of overlaps significantly with Backbeat, and then their return to Liverpool, their signing with Brian Epstein. And their release of their first singles, and then it ends with them about to take America by storm.
Yeah, it ends with Ed Sullivan performing the first one, yeah.
Now, the other point to make about the music is that while it has successfully secured whatever rights they are in order to be able to have Lennon McCartney songs, it's used, the songs are quite anachronistic.
Yeah, so it's certainly they're playing... I saw her standing there at the Kaiser Keller, which is a song that they wouldn't write for a year or so. George is playing Don't Bother Me in Hamburg, which I think he writes in 64, maybe. And there's Ask Me Why as well as a song that's in there. I couldn't tell you when that was written, but, I don't think they had it at that point. But also, in Hamburg, they weren't performing original songs at all, basically. Yeah. It was all covers, I think that John and Paul essentially stopped writing songs while they were in Hamburg.
Right.
More or less. I don't know how deliberately, but I think essentially they didn't write any when over there. I think mainly just because they were busy and tired.
Didn't have time.
So, yeah, I think the idea that they were playing original songs at that time is not true, but, it's not... I was thinking about this and I thought, it's an obvious anomaly to point to. But, it's not the end of the world putting a song in a scene when it hadn't been written. But I wonder why do it? What's it designed to achieve?
I think I always have to remind myself to give the benefit of the doubt a little bit for films made in this era. Mm. Because the only thought that probably went into it was, this is going to be a Beatles biopic. We need to try to give the audiences songs that they recognise as being officially by the Beatles, and they can play a bit. And the other thing that I always had to remind myself is that films that were made at this time weren't really expected to be seen beyond its release at the cinema.
Yeah.
There wasn't really a big enough sort of home entertainment movement for the filmmakers to expect these films to be watched over and over again on repeat and be picked apart. in the way that we've built an entire podcast around.
Yeah.
So you can kind of allow it the liberty, I think, of including Beatles songs for the sake of it being a film about the Beatles, and that would be a nice thing for audiences to see in cinemas at the time.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also, like, it's hard to watch these things and think, there's obviously no sort of internet culture around this time. There was no, what for people to sort of to pick holes in it, what would the forum have been for them to do so? Fanzines or something like that? I don't know.
I think possibly just letters. Sending lots of letters to people.
Just writing letters to each other. Yeah. Just saying, did you notice that they played Ask Me Why on stage in Hamburg in 1961? How preposterous. Yours sincerely.
Yes, that's exactly the kind of thing you would have done. There's another element to this film as well, which I think is really, which was pointed out in that introduction, which I think is really felt in the film, and that is serving as technical consultant on the movie is Pete Best, as I messaged you the other day, Pete's biased, because
I thought that was a typo, actually.
Did you?
It didn't even occur to me.
My very, very clever joke.
Yeah, it's a very clever joke. Yeah.
Yeah, so Pete Best seems to be telling a slightly different version of events around his role in the group and his subsequent sacking of the group, which differs from the one that we, I think, generally understand from everyone else involved.
He's been pretty consistent with his version of events in his defence, which I think is fair enough. And who's to say he's not? It's not true what he says, you know. Mm. So the film, you're quite right, absolutely takes the stance that Pete was unfairly sacked. And I don't think anyone disputes that his sacking was quite unceremonious and not very sensitively handled.
Mm.
And I suppose at this point, 1979, so Pete would still have... Pete was sort of working for Liverpool Council or something like that at this point, you know, and it had been for years. As far as he was concerned, that was his career. He hadn't made any money off the Beatles, and he didn't until the release of Anthology, when the versions of Love Me Do and PS I Love You appeared on that with his drumming on it, and he was entitled to money, you know, and he made some money off that, and good for him. At this point, I guess if he was going to quite justifiably make any money from his experiences, he could really only do it by doing things like this, being a consultant on a film, or sort of going to Beatle
conventions.
Going to Beatle conventions, that sort of thing. And it's fair enough for him to put his side of the story. But yes, it what it basically shows is that his drumming was absolutely fine.
Mm.
I think that when he's sacked, he says, but George Martin said, you know, my drumming was fine. EMI liked my drumming, I think is what he said, which is not true.
Yeah, it's that's just, right.
I mean, that's the opposite of true, you know. So,
false?
And yes. And so it may be that he genuinely didn't know that. Maybe he had been told that by Brian Epstein, EMI liked your drumming.
Right.
Or it may be that that had been refuted in biographies already by then. I'm not completely sure.
That's a really good point. So the version of events that we understand now, maybe that wasn't revealed until after this film was made.
Possibly, yeah. Because this is the thing. I mean, as we were saying, looking at these stories afresh by sort of doing these episodes, as we discovered with the Backbeat episode, it does make you realise that you've had so many tellings of these stories. Mm-hmm. That they have formed your impression of what the events actually were. As you know, I think we both found that, you know, when we thought of Stuart Sutcliffe, we generally thought of Stephen Dorff in Backbeat, because that's where our impression of him first came from, you know. And so it's a similar thing here. In my mind, the story of the Beatles and Hamburg and Pete Best sacking is just sort of set in my head, but it's useful to sort of interrogate where those tellings come from, because at what point those narratives became to predominate, you know.
And so I think that's fair. I think that's probably the biggest part of the story, the biggest problem, I guess, with that scene is that as unceremonious as the sacking was in real life, it's unceremonious in the film as well. Like, the film doesn't really build up to that. And I, you know, one of the problems I have with the film overall is that, as I feel like this is a point I make in lots of biopics, but this film is very much a chronological telling of events as opposed to it telling a complete story.
Yes.
It doesn't feel like there is a conflict and a resolution that comes out of this movie.
Yeah.
If you're going to have Pete Best as your technical consultant, maybe his is the story that you tell.
Yeah.
You know, like that, and then the way that was handled, the way that his story, I realize this is a different movie altogether, but like that would make sense for a film and a story to be told in a film. But this kind of leaves as it's picking up and these big significant events that happen in the Beatles' career, like his sacking, like Stuart Sutcliffe's death, I don't actually feel like they have any real impact in this film because they're not vital to what the film is trying to do, which is just basically explore what the Beatles did in that time period.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's the Wikipedia page on the screen. It's
exactly really. That, yeah.
And yeah, no, you're right. Like, yeah, if you're going to have telling the Pete Best story, it'd be interesting, you know, it could be like, you know, like the wrestler, you know, the Darren Aronofsky film, like the Nearly Man kind of thing. You know, like I could have been part of the biggest thing in the world, and you know, and now here I am working for the council. Like that's an interesting film. It's not this film, but I mean, that is an entirely different film than The Prospect, because obviously what they want to do here is make the Beatles biopic. You know,
yes, and I think the. Just a couple of last points on Pete Best. I feel like you have to take the version, some of the versions of events that feature him prominently with a pinch of salt, because he's the one who's advising on them. But there are other sort of bits in the film that I picked up on that felt like they really showed him in a very good light. And I was like, is that because he's fed that in? So there was a point in the film where they made it seem as though he was the real heartthrob of the band. And that might have caused some jealousy. Well, it's something that Pete Best, I think, accuses Lennon of at some point, and they kind of like banter about it. Like it's a very like sort of split second moment.
There is truth in him being thought of as the heartthrob of the band. Yeah,
right. Okay, this is what I wanted to check for you. And I know that there is truth in the backlash that they had at the Cavern when he left and Ringo replaced him.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was quite the same as, like, you know, them turning up in the car and everyone protesting outside and things. But but certainly, yeah, so that whole chant, Pete forever, Ringo never, all that stuff.
Yeah.
That was all true. But no, I mean, certainly it is true that he was considered, like, the good-looking one. He had a big sort of brooding, quiet thing going on. And the girls in the audience were really keen on him. But it's not necessarily true that's why he was sacked, that the other Beatles were jealous of the attention he was getting. So that's his version of the events. It's not the other Beatles.
Is it true that all Ringo had to do to win over that really aggressively violent crowd was play a prolonged extended drum roll?
Yes. Yeah. No, it's not. No, I'm sure it's not.
Because that seemed very strange.
But it's interesting that I found that scene quite interesting in that Pete is introduced as a character by playing like a really rad drum solo, you know, and it's like, hey, who's this guy, right. You know, and then they say like, do you want to be in the group? And he says, oh, well, only if it's going to be a proper thing, like, you know, whereas I think actually they needed someone to go to Hamburg with. They had to have a drummer, otherwise they couldn't get the gig. They had to find someone quickly. They knew Pete as Mona Best's son, who had sort of been in bands and had a drum kit, and, you know, as far as they were aware, was a competent drummer, and that was kind of it, really. You know, but yeah, I thought it was interesting the way they juxtaposed that with Ringo doing something similar, this sort of long drum solo thing that sort of commands the audience's attention, because I feel like they did almost, you know, if you take this as like Pete Best's story, there seemed to be some acceptance in that this guy was, you know, was a better drummer, or at least as good a drummer, and brought something to the Beatles as well. So, but you know, who knows whether that was his influence or not?
Yeah, there's no way of sort of isolating what he would have fed in, is there?
No.
My other favourite moment, if you view it through the lens of Pete Best has informed this film, and this won't have been the case, but I liked the idea that he was the one who insisted that this scene was told in this way, is when Stuart Sutcliffe is set upon and beaten up in the alleyway.
Yeah.
And Pete Best comes on and he's the one who lands the punches, yeah, ducks out the way. He's the real action hero of the group. Right? Everyone else rushes to Stu's aid and Pete's like seeing off the attackers up the stairs and stuff. And he's like, yeah. I really love the idea of Pete going, no, that's how it went. That's how it went. You have to make sure that I'm the one. I hit him twice.
Yeah. And actually, like, I think I had my shirt off actually. Like, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And then I think I kissed a girl straight afterwards. Like,
I really hope that was the case. That's what happened.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You mentioned before about how certain allowances would have to be made for a film that is trying to do this particular job.
Yeah.
And that job is trying to be a biopic of the Beatles at a certain stage of their career.
Yeah.
We've talked lots of times, probably on this podcast, certainly off many, many times, about what a good version of a Beatles biopic looks like.
Yeah.
How close do you think this film comes to that?
Well, this is the closest thing to a Beatles biopic that exists, I think.
More so than Backbeat.
Yes, because it's not just covering... Well, so but Backbeat is quite self-contained in that it's covering Liverpool, Hamburg, and then there's a thing at the end saying John Lennon would go on to do all this and be amazing.
Yeah.
And what this does, it ends at it has to choose a point at which to end, mm-hmm. right? So it ends at Ed Sullivan, which is a good point, as good a point as any to say this is, you know, Beatlemania is about to start properly or as a global thing. And, you know, they went on to do this. So it's the only thing that is even attempting to cover their story as a whole, excluding documentaries, of course. You know, I mean, so it's the only narrative film that is even starting to do that. As far as I'm concerned, it's inevitable that there will be a sort of Beatles narrative biopic at some point.
Mm.
Studios have seen how well Bohemian Rhapsody did. And Rocket Man, it must be on the cards. There must be scripts going around, you know.
Yeah.
And the big question is, how do you do that? Now, those films, even Bohemian Rhapsody as a comparison, although it's about a band, but it focuses much more on Freddie Mercury than it does the other three. And it is easier to do it through the lens of one person's story than it is through a whole band's story. Now, the Beatles are... It would be underserved by that approach because they're all individually so fascinating as far as I'm concerned. And it would be, I suppose the obvious way to do it in a similar way to Bohemian Rhapsody is that John would be the sort of main character. And, you know, you've got, and obviously the backstory for him with the childhood trauma, it's sort of tailor-made for that. But I mean, then it would just be a sort of John Lennon story with the other guys as side people, you know. So
we've kind of done that three times now in this podcast alone. Like, you've got Backbeats, John Lennon takes the center stage there. Yeah. Obviously, Nowhere Boy is about John Lennon,
yeah.
But that is, you know, it sort of takes a similar approach. And now this one,
yeah.
Right? This puts more emphasis on John's role than anybody else.
Yeah, just
but about. Very, very lightly.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the thing. I mean, so what Birth of the Beatles does is it doesn't take any of their story. There's lots and lots of sort of banter and back and forth and stuff like that. So you get a bit of an impression of them as a group. You get no impression of any of them as individuals. And so when it does... when it covers the same ground as Backbeat, so Stu's death and how John reacted to that. Here he sort of makes a speech on stage that says he was my best friend and now he's dead. And you think, oh, was he your best friend? I didn't...
Yes, yeah, I didn't, exactly. Didn't come across that at all.
No, no idea. And, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, doing the Beatles story in a sort of two-hour narrative film is basically impossible. If you did it in a six-episode TV series or something like that, you'd have a shot at it.
So here's my pitch for the only way I can be happy or satisfied with a decent Beatles biopic.
Yeah.
Do it like The Crown.
Yeah.
Do it like over a long period, like be committed to doing several seasons, each covering a different period in the Beatles' career and life, and then you have the territory there to explore each of its different phases.
Yeah.
That are all worthy of their own stories being told, but you can also have those individual episodes that pick out the mini stories that happen in between them along the way.
Yeah,
I feel like that's the only way I'd be happy with that. Who knows whether that might ever see the light of day or something like that, but that would be my the only way I can see any overall Beatles biopic being sensibly made. Like a 2-hour film just can't cut it.
No, exactly.
Because what story are you telling there?
Yeah. No, exactly. But I wonder whether, like, as Beatles fans, we only think that way because we're Beatles fans. And actually, you know, if you were to try and do a Rolling Stones biopic, for example, like, in my head, that feels quite easy. Because you've got some peaks and troughs and whatnot. But narratively, that doesn't feel too difficult. But maybe that's only because I'm not a big Rolling Stones fan, and I'm not particularly invested in their story, and I don't find their story all that fascinating.
I feel like the question is less about whether or not you can pack everything into a film, and more about what is the actual story you're trying to tell in that film. Mm. So with Freddie Mercury, obviously, it's his own, you know, tragic tale of AIDS and, you know, succumbing to that. And with Elton John, it's about him overcoming drug addiction, alcoholism, so many ways. What is the story you tell in the Beatles' career that spans their whole, from start to finish, their whole career?
Yeah.
And I don't know what you lead with on that. How they become friends. They start off with friends, how they join, and then how they eventually split up.
Yeah.
Like, there isn't really an individual through line that carries, I think, all the way across that period.
No, that's true. And I guess it's just because Lennon's story is the one that has been told the most.
Yeah.
It just seems like the obvious way you would do it. But yeah, I just... The sort of pain and trauma he went through, and then, you know, there are kind of obvious parallels when he meets Yoko, and that, you know, and he was sort of not even especially quiet about the fact that he sort of saw her as a mother figure in some ways, you know. So, you know, guy loses his mother... Guy eventually finds a woman who he treats a bit like his mother. You know, that is a bit of a through line. But then you can really only do that by having John the main character and the other three are kind of side, you know, side characters, really. Which is
kind of where this film lands by default, I think.
But, I suppose.
Only because the film presents the very real depiction of Lennon as the leader of the band.
Yeah.
So I think it makes sense that he ends up having a bit more, a slightly more commanding presence in certain scenes than the other three. So think of how the film ends, and it ends with Epstein talking to him about fame and conquering America.
Mm.
Lennon is the one who goes to see Epstein and finds that he'd been beaten up, and talks to him about that and about how they always knew he was gay.
Yeah.
He's the one who has those scenes. The other four don't. So it feels like he's a bit more bigger presence.
Yeah.
Which leads to, I think, one of the biggest problems that the film has, which is Lennon isn't very good.
No.
The portrayal of Lennon isn't very good.
No. And one of the main problems with that is the actor Stephen McKenna, who's playing him, is 35, and he's playing a 20-year-old John Lennon.
He's 35 and looks 40 as
yes,
well.
Yes, and actually, so it's not just that you look at him and think, oh, he looks a bit old. It's that it completely and utterly changes the tone of almost every scene he's in. Mm-hmm. The way the other Beatles interact with him. Now, it's certainly true that the others, Paul especially, has said, we all used to look up to him. He was the leader and he was a bit older and we kind of all wanted to please him a bit. That's absolutely fine. But here, he is so much older than the rest of them that it just feels like he's sort of their uncle or something like that.
Yeah.
And there's the scene where Stu comes in to talk to John in his bedroom in Hamburg and tells him that he's going to leave the group and he's going to stay in Hamburg with Astrid. John is sort of sitting on his bed writing, and he sort of tells Stu about Preludin. And he sort of offers him, he's got like a little jar of them, and he says, I'll have one of mine. And it's sort of like a kindly teacher.
yes, that's exactly what it is.
And then just the way that he's sitting there and the way he looks at Stu, it's like he might as well be looking at him over the top of his half-moon glasses.
You know, yeah, no, that's exactly
it's
right.
It's like sort of kindly uncle receiving a sort of nervous nephew. And it is so completely different. He plays him sort of slightly... He plays John kind of slightly camp as well, which, you know, John could be, you know, quite camp in his sense of humour sometimes, but the way McKenna plays him is like that's a sort of, that's just sort of the way he is all the time, which doesn't make a lot of sense. And he just doesn't fit in any scene he's in.
I mean, I know we haven't really dug properly into, I guess, the comparisons between this film and Backbeat, but... you said at the time about how Ian Hart obviously often plays Lennon as more acerbic.
Mm.
There's not an ounce of that in this portrayal.
No.
Like, he's very much like the amiable uncle. Is exactly that. He doesn't even seem necessarily quick-witted.
No.
Either. He's very sort of generally quite happy to, you know, be with his friends. And he's having a lovely time. He's having a lovely time, this John Lennon is.
Yeah. Yeah, because then... Is he packing for Hamburg, or he's telling Mimi he's going to Hamburg for the first time? And she says something about Julia, who is by now like dead, like recently dead.
Mm.
And John says, and John sort of mentions her name and just sort of looks like mournfully out of the window. And then that's it. Like,
yes.
That is the whole mention of Julia and the effect she's had on him and stuff. Now, I mean, listen, to be fair, as we were saying, if, you know, this isn't a giant John Lennon biopic, it's a Beatles biopic. So maybe they're thinking, well, we don't want to focus too much on this guy. We don't want to get into his backstory too much because he's not the main character. But you've got to do something.
Yeah. You know? And Paul doesn't get a moment like that.
No, that's true.
Yeah. Talking about the cast, I really enjoyed playing a spot, the low-level TV actor celebrity throughout. There was quite a lot.
Yeah.
Lots of soap actors involved.
Yep.
Is it Nick Cotton?
Nick Cotton from EastEnders playing George.
Playing George. That's quite a good shout.
Yeah, yeah.
Others? Any other faves? Yeah. I like seeing Nigel Havers pop up as George Martin. I thought that was really good casting,
That was good casting, yeah.
That was great.
So there's a guy, the guy who plays, the kid who goes into NEMS and asks for My Bonnie.
Oh, yeah.
Who's Liverpudlian actor. And so in real life, that kid's name is well known, but I can't remember it right now. But he is played by one of the guys who went on to be one of the Scousers in Harry Enfield.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I recognised him straight away.
Oh, right.
I could really, you know.
I didn't spot it straight away, actually. It was only afterwards that I realised it was him. But when the Beatles don't have a drummer during their audition, a guy has to step up and perform with them. That's Robert Glenister.
Oh.
Who's obviously been in loads of TV stuff
recently.
And I think my favourite spot in this was that one of the early club bosses, it might have been the guy who owned Club Keller, was Colonel Kurt von Strom from Hello, Hello.
So is he playing some...
Always a pleasure to see. Yes, he is.
Bruno Koschmider. Has he got the monocle, that guy?
No, it's not him. No, it's the bigger, grumpier, more overweight guy.
Oh, okay. Maybe Horst Facker. I'm not sure they actually give those characters names, or they're supposed to be.
I can't remember what his actor's name is, but it was really good to see it. It's always a pleasure to see anyone from LOLO pop up in any film you watch.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, talking of screen talent, here's a question for you. Something very, very, very exciting for me happened in this film within the first scene.
Yeah.
Well, when the credits came up. Yeah. Can you guess what that might have been?
No, I don't think I can.
I'll give you a clue. It's the director
right.
of this film.
Yeah.
The director of this film, it's not even a clue anymore, I'm just going to tell you. Right. Very, very exciting. When this popped up, I was like, oh my God, this is going to be, I'm really interested in seeing this film now suddenly. Okay. Not that it wasn't before. The director is Richard Marquand.
Yep.
Who you all know has been equally as exciting as I am.
Yeah.
For 4 years after this film was made, he went on to direct Return of the Jedi.
Did he?
Yes. I know, right?
Wow.
So he was, there's a lot of conjecture around how him directing Return of the Jedi was really just him being a voice piece to filter what George Lucas wanted the whole way through. So it was kind of like a yes man for George Lucas. So
yeah.
George Lucas did the first Star Wars film. He got his old film teacher, Irving Kirshner, to direct Empire Strikes Back.
Right.
And then Richard Marquand was sort of brought in, hired to direct Return of the Jedi.
Wow.
So yeah, 4 years before Star Wars Episode 6, Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
The director was making Birth of the Beatles. So I was very excited. I was like, this is brilliant. I'm gonna really see where the talent from, you know, a franchise that I love and adore and have all my life, the talent for one of those important installments, how that shines through in this film.
Yeah.
But yeah, this kind of film, especially this period film that's kind of gone a little bit underserved, I always enjoy playing spot the name that I know from elsewhere.
So Richard Marquand is not a name I would have known. I couldn't have told you who directed Return of the Jedi. It's sort of interesting to be given this job. It would have been a big deal, right? To being given the Birth of the Beatles directing.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that is true.
Pretty big deal, I would have thought. Even though, I mean, sort of 79 was a point where the Beatles were sort of quite unfashionable in general. People weren't really listening to them. You know, the sort of punk movement had kind of dismissed them, and it wasn't until John died a year or so later that they, you know, they started to be sort of reappraised and become a bit more popular again. But even so, it would have been quite a big deal to be given a job like this.
And looking at his filmography, he hadn't really done much before he was given this either. Filmed a few shorts, a few episodes of TV, and there was one movie that he'd made before this, which looks to me like it is a pretty ropey horror film,
right,
called The Legacy. So yeah, but you're right, yeah, it's interesting that he was given the task of being in charge of, you know, what at that point was the first Beatles biopic. Talking of it being a Beatles biopic, we've sometimes mentioned this before in other films like this, where sometimes there are sort of fun little Easter eggs, some sort of nods that happen in the film to what we know about the Beatles and who they eventually become. Did you spot any?
Well, I spotted one that was what they were trying to do. And then there's the thing, you know, the where are we going, fellas, to the toppermost of the poppermost, right?
Yes.
So they do that, but they get it wrong and they say, where are we going, fellas, to the very top.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's weird. And then they do it again later.
Yeah.
And when they start doing it, I was thinking, oh, maybe they're going to do the proper version now because it's like showing them how that phrase has developed over time or whatever. No, they just did the same thing again. And so I was thinking, why? So either they didn't know that was the phrase, because again, like I say, it's 1979. We didn't necessarily know all this Beatle trivia that we do now. Maybe it's that. You know, maybe it's actually Pete Best just misremembered it.
Yes, yeah.
Maybe they never really said it around Pete Best because he wasn't really part of the gang. And he just
he was always
them.
Just out of earshot. Yeah. He knew it was something about being at the top, but
he heard them in another room. And he was like, oh yeah, I think it was that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think to the very top, something like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I seem to remember them saying something about going to the top as Brian Epstein was telling me I'm no longer in the band. They're in the room next door chanting about being.
But that was strange, because it's not like, that is the most likely explanation, that actually they didn't, it was a misremembering by someone or other of a thing they used to say to each other. Because it's not like the phrase is copyrighted or anything and they had to use a different version of it or something like that, you know.
For the purposes of this dramatisation, the phrase "go into the top" has been performed by Rain. There was only one scene where I felt like there's a couple of things that have been shoehorned in here badly.
Mm.
And it was right at the start. They're hanging out, I think they were having fish and chips or something, in a graveyard.
Yeah.
And one of them, I think it might be Lennon, was lying across a gigantic tomb.
Yeah.
And there were massive letters on the side saying Rigby.
Were there?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed that.
Which is brilliant.
Right.
And okay. In that same scene, I think they're kind of lamenting not being famous or hoping they're going to be famous or not really, you know, being as big as they want to be right now.
Yeah.
And one of them says, it's got to get better, right? And the other one says, can't get no worse.
Yeah.
And just a few things like that. And because that happened so early on, I was like, oh, it's going to be one of those films where this kind of stuff happens all the way through. And I think that I didn't really notice anymore.
Yeah, no, you're right, actually. Yeah. Yeah, because we've spoken about this a few times before, haven't we, on other episodes, of this whole thing of even Backbeat does it, where it has a few lines where people say like the titles of songs in conversation years before they would actually be songs as a nice little Easter egg. And it can get a bit grating. But yeah, you're right. I thought exactly the same thing. Oh, this is going to be a theme throughout the whole thing. Yeah. It just sort of drops it, you know.
Yeah, completely gives it up. Yeah, I thought that was the only like sort of clever thing that the scriptwriter had put in and then didn't think of anymore.
yeah.
Going back to Backbeat now, let's just cover it off because I did find it interesting. I knew going into this film that it was going to cover much of the same ground that Backbeat does, 15 years later or however much time has passed. I was surprised when I was looking at reviews of this film, current reviews of this film, not from when it was released, but current reviews of the film, almost all of them from critics and fans and, you know, audiences alike, almost all of them mentioned Backbeat.
Yeah.
So it just feels like a comparison of the two is inevitable.
Yeah.
Because it covers the same ground.
Yeah.
What do you think this one gets right compared to Backbeat, and what do you think gets wrong compared to Backbeat?
Well, I think the music is the main thing, as I say. It's sort of entirely bloodless and passionless, and you don't get any sense of the excitement that they generated in those clubs at all. I think it does have a good sense of the interplay between them as friends, the way they would riff off each other.
I feel like a lot of that actually reminded me of Help.
Yeah.
When we were watching that, like this, I was thinking, in a lot of films, you'll have the kind of like quick back and forth between friends, and it's so rapid fire that you think, well, this doesn't feel natural because it feels that you've learnt your scripted lines and you're, you know, saying them straight off the bat, and as a result, it feels, you know, performative, and it feels like that in this film, but actually, the impression I get is that they were just like that.
Yeah. I get that impression to some degree. I mean, you see it in Get Back, don't you? Of course. You
know, yes, exactly.
They're sort of riffing off each other, but it's not quite the same. As they have a shared sense of humour in a way you can see would have been quite difficult for outsiders to penetrate, as Michael Lindsay-Hogg discovers in Get Back. it's just very, very difficult to sort of penetrate.
Quite devastatingly.
yeah. To sort of penetrate that inner circle of, you know, and it must have been so hard, you know. Mick Jagger used to call him the four-headed monster, you know. That thing of just, this is obviously a gang, a unit, and it must be hard for anyone else to get in. But, and so I suppose you do get a bit of a sense of that in Birth of the Beatles. And, I mean, not that I think any of their sort of banter dialogue is actually very funny. But you do get at least a bit of a bit of a sense of what they were like in that regard, I guess. Yeah.
And you don't get that in Backbeat. You're right. Like there's a bit more.
Not so much, no. Because
there's some. Lennon has more sort of like, you know, Lennonian. I think you created.
Yeah.
You termed in a previous episode Lennonian witticisms that he has, but there's not necessarily a group dynamic that explores that kind of banter.
Yeah.
So, you know, this film does something good.
Yeah, I think I think also the staging of the Ed Sullivan performance as well, I think is really well done. Because that is the only point where there is sort of energy in the room around them. The way that the audience is filmed, you know, the girls screaming and whatnot, and the way that we're shown they perform as musicians is sort of above the din of this noise.
Mm.
Gives a good sense of that. Like, it's quite palpable in a way that, you know, just makes you think, why didn't you shoot the other? Why didn't you show the other performance scenes like this?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
just like
makes sense.
Like you have a way to bring energy to the room in these scenes. Why didn't you do that before? It may be that what they really were trying to show was how sort of crazy Beatlemania was, as opposed to the sort of success or popularity that they'd had just in Liverpool. But I mean, if so, it's a strange decision. But you know, that scene is well framed.
Yeah, I agree. It ends on a good note. It ends on a high.
Yeah,
I think as much as it, I feel like what would have made more sense for me, again, I always feel like I'm banging on about this idea of a sense of story in the films. What would have made more sense is if the film had set up this ultimate goal of them going to America.
Yeah.
So that's the point at which the film ends on, and it, you know, then you're sort of rounding things off. But as it stands, it just feels like we're just getting the next step of their success.
Mm.
And then it ends and it's for us to sort of, you know.
Yeah, because it is the only sort of conflict and resolution that it's really building is sort of towards the end, when it's suggested to you that John is unsure about whether there's, he says to Brian, you know, I'm not sure about America, Brian. I don't know if we're going to go over well. I don't think that was true. I think they were all just by that point pretty confident that anything they did was going to go great.
Yeah.
And there's a weird scene where everyone is celebrating, having a party in a hotel room. And John turfs everyone out and smashes the place up and says, everyone get out, you know, and you think, what's up with you?
The impetus for that was Mimi arriving and saying, is this really what you want, John?
Right.
And it's supposed to, the idea is that it's led to this sort of real, like, character revelation, where it's like, oh, yeah, you're right. Maybe this isn't what I want.
Yeah.
And he has like a moment of doubt. It takes Brian Epstein to be like, no, this is great. Are you kidding me? This is like, you've got champagne and girls and fame and money. Like, let's go on. And he's like, yeah, all right.
yeah. The end.
Sounds good, actually. Yeah, the end. Credits,
Pretty much literally, right?
That's how it works,
But it's strange in that, it's either what it's doing is, like, as you say, just sort of setting up a conflict that is then immediately resolved for the sake of having a conflict and resolving it. Or it's suggesting that at John's heart was like a sort of fundamental lack of confidence about whether or not he and the Beatles were good enough. And that guy had a lot of issues and a lot of traumas. But whether or not the Beatles were a good band was not something he struggled with, I don't think. I think he and all the rest of them were always very, very confident of how good they were.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, so we covered a lot of the elements of the film. There are two more things that I just wanted to touch on because they feel important. One is, what do we think of the portrayal of Lennon's relationship with Cynthia in the film? How do you think that goes? One thing I will say is Cynthia has more elevated role in this film than she does in Backbeat.
Yeah.
But much less is made of the fact, understandably, because given the era, much less is made of the idea that Lennon was going off to Hamburg and meeting loads of girls and doing things behind Cynthia's back that he probably shouldn't have done.
Yeah. The first thing is, so I looked up their age difference. So he is 14 years older than Wendy Morgan, who is playing Cynthia. So again, it makes those scenes just read very strangely.
Yeah.
And, you know, it feels like a teacher seducing a pupil almost.
Yeah.
You know.
Because the whole thing is very, like, Lennon feels very sanitized in this film.
Yeah.
I think that doesn't help. Like, it's that, you know, it's the same thing, that sort of teacher vibe.
Yeah.
Friendly teacher vibe.
I was thinking, so the scene in which she says she's pregnant.
Yeah.
I was just trying to remember how that was handled, because I can picture it. But I think he basically just says, well, there's only one thing for it. We'll have to get married.
Yes. And he says, but our kids aren't going to grow up without a father like me.
That's it. Right? Yeah.
But there is the hint that, and it's played relatively well in that there's a hint of, you don't know Lennon's going to fly off the handle out of that. But I feel like maybe I'm putting that on the film because we know what kind of, how unpredictable Lennon could be. And we've seen portrayals of him obviously coming straight to mind, where you wouldn't know how that version of the character of Lennon would handle that information.
Yeah.
But actually, in hindsight, there's only one way this film is going to tell that part of the story, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be Lennon, stepping up and doing the right thing. The other thing that I wanted to touch on as well, it feels really important that we talk it through, is what do you think of the portrayal of Brian Epstein in the film?
I think it's funny, with portrayals of Brian, because I always think that he's often portrayed as like like he is his sexuality, his character is his sexuality, and that can lead to the feeling there wasn't much more to him, which is, and it's, I sort of get why they're doing it, because it's a character trait that, for the time, there is obvious conflict there. If he's being played by an actor, there is obvious conflict in the fact that he's gay and that is illegal at the time. And, how are the Beatles, who are sort of, rough and ready lads, going to react to this and all that kind of thing? And, I think they took the piss out of him a bit, but they were fine with it, And I often feel like that sort of leads people to think of him as quite one note. I remember watching Anthology when it came out in the, in the mid-90s, and there's a montage about Brian, maybe after his death, that is done to You've Got to Hide Your Love Away. And I remember thinking, there's an obvious reason why you've used that song. But actually, maybe it's a bit reductive, thinking of him as a guy who had to be a closeted gay man, and that's the end of that. Much more to the guy's character. So, I don't know. His portrayal in this, I understand why you go down that road. But yeah, it makes it a little bit one note, I think.
I think you're completely right. I think the shame about how this is this character how Brian is portrayed in the film is that because there's that element of him hiding his sexuality, he's unsure of himself in every scene, and I think that does him a disservice. It doesn't really feel like he has sort of the business or managerial acumen that he would have had at the time, and he's kind of made out in the film that he's got resources and contacts and wealth that he can put into making the band success, but not necessarily the expertise that he obviously had.
Right, he's a bit of a chancer almost, isn't
he? And that doesn't really come across in the film, right? And when you look at the little sort of footage I've seen of interviews with Brian, or where he's sort of talking directly on camera, he seems very in control. He's very confident. He's always feels like he's bold. I think in terms of how he talks about the band and about how he talks about how they're going to be successful and continue to be successful. It's a very different Brian in this film. He's constantly on the back foot from the group, or he's cowering in some way. It's a bit of a shame.
The period as well where he's sort of hawking their demo around. So this period, he would, in real life, he would go down to London on the train, and he'd have meetings arranged, and he'd kind of hawk around this demo tape, and then he'd come back up. And I think they all used to meet in a cafe near Lime Street Station at sort of, at sort of midnight or something, when he would get in and he would come in and say, sorry, no luck this time, boys.
Yeah.
So here in this film, it's portrayed as they're one of the bits where Lennon is a bit acerbic.
Yes.
Where he says, well, we're fulfilling our side of the bargain, Brian. Why aren't you doing your job? And I'm not sure there was much of that.
It felt like it came out of nowhere. And also it was a bit of a, that's just not, it didn't seem to ring true.
No.
Like what he's saying, like, we're fulfilling our end of the bargain. What about you? What do you mean? What bargain? Like, you're writing and you're, being a band,
yeah,
and this guy's trying to make you successful. It's not like a trade-off. It's not,
yeah,
you know, you're both working towards the same goal. It's just a bit of an odd sort of stance to take in that moment.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of little missteps as well about how they were received by... Really good example, actually, is... So Nigel Havers as, you know, the two sort of... most prominent acting heavyweights in the whole thing. Nigel Havers as George Martin and Nick Cotton. Oh God, stop calling him that. John it's John Altman as George Harrison. So you know the two Georges and the famous line when they first meet. You know, is there anything you don't like, boys? Well, I don't like your tie for a start.
Yeah.
And the way that Nigel Havers as George Martin receives that line is to just go, oh, yes, well. Fine, okay, you know, and sort of goes off and says, "Oh God, these are quite rough boys, aren't they?" You know, and I in real life, that was a big icebreaker. Apparently,
yeah,
like they got to realize that this guy had a sense of humor and he enjoyed their sense of humor as well. You know, it wasn't a thing where they were coming in and sort of disrupting this guy's whole routine where he's in there, you know, sort of sergeant major type and like doesn't like his routine disrupted and they come in and muck about, you know.
I don't think it's interesting that happens elsewhere in the film where he's listening to their demo and he can hear them talking between songs and joking. And he's like, oh, they've got a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Like they pick that element out of their relationship. But it's weird that it is presented in the film as something that he's hearing on the tape as opposed to them actually interacting with each other.
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, no, I hadn't thought about it in those terms, actually. Yeah, so he hears on the tape, yeah, oh, they've got a bit of a sense of humour. This is one of the things why he agrees to have them in the studio. And then they come into the studio and they have a sense of humour.
Yes,
and exactly. He goes, oh, I'm not so sure about these.
No, yeah.
This wasn't what I expected at all.
Right, I have covered everything that I had to say about Birth of the Beatles. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
I would like to add that John Altman as George Harrison, why is he doing a Birmingham accent? Like, it's that he's playing George Harrison as Jeff Lynne. You know, it's not the birth of the Travelling Wilburys. You know, other than that, no.
Fine, okay.
But I thought it would be remiss to let the episode go by without pointing
there,
out.
There are very few podcasts in this day and age that are talking about the John Altman accent gate.
No,
so if it falls on us to bring this to people's attention, then so be it.
Absolutely. Prepared to die on that hill.
On that bombshell. Let's wrap it up there. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode. If you have watched Birth of the Beatles, if you enjoyed listening to us talk about it, please feel free to get in touch and follow us on all the social media platforms at Beatles Films Pod. Also, if you've enjoyed listening to us chat about this film or any other episode, please feel free to leave us a review. That'd be very kind of you. Otherwise, and until then, we'll see you in the next episode. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.